Welcome to episode 14 of Lady Fiction, which turns to Indigenous erotica and Native body sovereignty in North American literature and culture in the month of November 22, which in the US is designated Native American Heritage Month. I'm honored to welcome as my guest today, Dr. Savage Bear, a member of the Montreal Lake Cree Nation in northern Saskatchewan and the director of the McMaster Indigenous Research Institute at McMaster University in Ontario, Canada. At the University of Alberta, Savage Bear was assistant professor for Native Studies and Women and Gender Studies and the director of the Indigenous Women and Youth Resilience Project. She also worked as academic lead on Indigenous Canada, a MOOC or massive open online course that was designed by Indigenous scholars with help from knowledge keepers and elders. This course is trailblazing in various ways, but most importantly, I think, is its amazing outreach. To date, this free open online course has been taken by over 500,000 learners, educating people from Canada and from around the world about Indigenous Canada. I was fortunate to witness Savage Bear's teaching in another context at the European Summer School for Canadian Studies, which was held this summer at the universities of Innsbruck and Vienna in Austria. And I'm still thrilled that she agreed to appear on Lady Fiction. Welcome, Savage.
Danse. It's really great to be here. Thanks. It's nice to see you again.
I agree. It's great to continue our conversation here. I'd like to start by acknowledging a little bit my own bubbliness when it comes to hosting you and my own bubbliness when it comes to talking about decolonizing sex. While I like to think that hopefully my discomfort doesn't emanate from the sex part, I think it might be the Indigenous part. So as a scholar of North American studies from Germany, I sometimes struggle to find a good position for talking about Native and Indigenous cultures in North America. In short, I approach the material when I teach this very differently as an educator, but also as a possible accomplice in the coercion that is colonization, because I teach it in an American studies or Canadian studies course. I'd like to start by asking about your understanding of the field and about the possibility of solidarity in the teaching experiment of this.
First off, thanks for having me on this show, Lady Fiction. I love the title of it. For those of you that don't know where I am, I'm not in Austria right now. I'm in Canada, what's now known as Canada. And I'd like to do a bit of a land acknowledgement. I am Cree from Treaty 6 territory in Canada. There's 11 numbered treaties in Canada, and Cree people live mostly in Treaty 6 territory. But right now, I am actually in Ontario, in Hamilton, and at the University McMaster. So McMaster University sits on land protected by the Dish with One Spoon Wampum Agreement. And I am a guest on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the Credit and the Haudenosaunee nations. This territory was never surrendered, it was never ceded, and further, the Crown has ignored and reneged on many nation-to-nation treaties. Settlements and promises of these treaties remain unfulfilled. We stand with all the Indigenous peoples of Canada who defend their territories, lands, and waters. So I am a guest on this territory, but I am coming to you with an open heart to talk about some exciting topics, at least exciting for me. So your first question, Stephanie, was about the field. Is it the field of Indigenous studies particularly, or a specific field in Indigenous studies?
I think it's, as a scholar of American studies or North American studies, it's always a question of how to address that Indigenous presence that should be awarded national status of its own, but as you just said in your land acknowledgement, hasn't. So it's complicated coming to this in an American studies course that I, you know, I'm made to teach to German students who also have courses in British literature, Shakespeare, and other courses. This is a institutional question at the beginning of this podcast. And I wonder how to turn the tables on that national question in the beginning, maybe with a land acknowledgement, as you just did, maybe also by acknowledging the embodiment of teaching and our own look across the pond mm-hmm. at this culture, and acknowledging the institutional bindings in the German-speaking university and the history of the discipline. And this is kind of improvising on what you just told me. But as an educator in Indigenous studies, what are the fields that you focus on? What is important to you, and what would you have me as an American studies scholar communicate to students?
I think it's really important, especially outside, external to Canada. Our Indigenous people's history with Canada is quite shameful. It's tragic. There's rarely any good parts to it, but it's kind of like being in the Matrix, though. You know, there's a blue pill and a red pill. And I think if we stay with sort of these easy histories of nationalism that maybe Canada, you know, in air quotes, conquered Indigenous people fairly, there's sort of a past that many Canadians and even the outside world haven't yet dealt with. They love to stay with the stereotypes, right? And we were talking before how every week I'm confronted with someone who, you know, notices my cultural tattoos, and they talk to me about, you know, their Indianness or their great grandmother being 100% Cherokee princess. And so I think there's still a romanticization that happens with Indigenous people. I can tell you so many stories of me traveling around the world, but especially Europe, where people have a really one-dimensional understanding mm-hmm. of Indigenous people, that they're somehow relegated to the past, that they're not nuanced in the future or in the present. Mm-hmm. So we're in this static mode of being dressed in buckskin and leather and, you know, lots of fringe, lots of feathers, lots of yeah. leather. But as you can see, I'm not wearing that. My hair isn't long anymore. So I think the biggest thing, if you're delving into Indigenous studies, is to have those bold conversations. What I mean by bold is be curious. Mm-hmm. Start with a beginner's mindset and be open and prepare to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because these aren't easy histories. My ancestors have gone through them, and it's important for people to realize that these histories are a part of our cultural fabric. And yeah, it's shameful, but there's no one's doing anyone ever any favors by ignoring that type of history. So when I talk about that history of Canada and Indigenous people, I don't usually start with a deficit model. By that, I mean, we don't talk about all the bad things colonialism yeah. did or the oppressive structures did. We talk about how Indigenous people were prior to contact and how they've changed, adapted, reimagined themselves, ourselves, as Indigenous people who are sovereign to these lands. So I would start there. And yeah. the interesting thing about Indigenous studies, and this quote comes from a Métis scholar, a friend of mine, Chris Anderson, and he said, Indigenous studies is unlike any other research area in the way that other research areas have complex ideas and concepts, and they simplify them for people. Indigenous studies is the exact opposite. You seemingly have this simple concept, but it's complexified by the history, the diversity of Indigenous people. So it's an amazing place to be. It's an amazing space, because not only do we have Indigenous past and present to talk about, I mean, there's Indigenous futurisms as well. So it's a great place to be right now.
I think so. I'm particularly interested, obviously, and I'm so happy that you agreed to talk to me about your expertise in Indigenous erotica. in decolonizing sex. Because from a European perspective that I'm kind of trying to grappling with in the teaching conversation that we're having here, of course, that's one of the taboo. And if I dare I use the word taboo here from psychoanalysis, one of the taboo topics. Laura Ann Stoller's work, for instance, she's a historian of empire. Recently, she turned to colonial intimacies and talked about how colonization governed, coerced indigenous and native sexualities and intimacies to begin with. So that's a change in historiography that's fairly recent. And I like to teach literature and, you know, aesthetic texts that broach this topic. And I am so intrigued by the new kind of shift to eco-erotics, different engagements with the land. I'd like to quickly acknowledge Joshua Whitehead's recent memoir / autobiography / whatever you want to call it. I mean, autobiography is already a colonizer term, so I'm kind of...
Life writing, perhaps.
Life writing is good, yes. So it's called Making Love to the Land. It's fascinating in literally shifting the grounds. So maybe we can start by talking about the essay that we both read, or I read preparing for this, by Melissa Nelson, Getting Dirty, which basically maps the field a little bit and starts by talking about her childhood memory, how she enjoyed eating and how she had a sensual experience that led her to design this concept of a pansexuality, a giving up of the body as being contained in a body that's governed by whatever cultural roots you have, into this enjoyment of the world that is erotic and sexual at the same time, but not in that terrible Puritan pornographic sense that related to colonizer culture.
Yeah, and, you know, in the way... When I talk about erotics, certainly sexuality can be a part of it, but mostly it's a sensuality, right? It's a sensuality of the senses and an uplifted sense of your surroundings and sense of self. And so it transcends that. And when I talk about Indigenous erotics, you know, some of the two major influences on me was, in fact, Audre Lorde's uses of the erotic, as well as the Kama Sutra of Vatsyayana, yeah, which is one of the oldest texts of the erotic that you'll find. So I explain what erotics is and the difference between erotics and Indigenous erotics. And I think you brought up Melissa K. Nelson's Eco-Erotics. It's an amazing article. And so she talks about that difference in how we see the land as something that's not disconnected from us. So when we look at the immersion of Canada as a state, you know, the French and English came here. And so we think about land being tamed, this ultimate wilderness being tamed, being civilized, somehow controlled. And the difference in the ontologies between sort of European mindset and Indigenous mindset is that land isn't meant to be tamed. Mm-hmm. That land is just doing fine without humans. And so we need to think about land as a caretaking thing rather than an ownership thing. Yep. So when you switch that mindset or that worldview, then you'll notice that, you know, what you do to the land does to you. And we're seeing that everywhere. I mean, we're seeing that everywhere with the waters and the land and our health as humans on this earth. Of what we're doing to the land is really what it's doing back to us. So we haven't been doing a very good job caretaking. So when you think of Indigenous erotics, it's really about that interconnectedness of Wakotwin. And so being a part of that. So when Melissa K. Nelson talks about that sensuality of the land, you know, I don't know if anyone's listening, if they've ever had that experience when you're outside and you just feel that moss, you can smell the moss and the feel of the squishiness or the hard bark on the tree, the sound of the river, the leaves falling down, like all of these things are a sensuality that may not be sexual at all, but there's a sensualness to it. And I think that's when I think about the erotic a lot in those types of moments on the land. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm with another human, right? It could be it's just about me and my senses.
Yes. And one of the appealing distinctions that I found preparing for our meeting today was the distinction between the split between the sensual and the pornographic that happens in settler cultures. So that anything that is sensual is all relegated to that, you know, pornographic industry, really, which then, of course, is fenced off. In North American culture, it's fenced off. Sexuality is ridden aside and out of public life and of being in the world in a way where it's adult and it's censored. And that is something that, you know, obviously dates to the, you know, Puritan influence and the regulation of the female body and the panic over female body sovereignty and, you know, sexual self expression. So that's even more powerful than I thought it was. And I worked on white feminisms quite a bit. And I was always struck by how there's not so much talk about sexual self-determination until the 20th century, where you get to the radical feminists. You know, the suffragettes are really interested in political participation, but they do it from a vantage point that, you know, perpetuates heteropatriarchy. They're not interested in acting up. So that's one of my scholarly questions that I've been looking at. But all the more intriguing is indigenous erotica and that different approach to building a continuum between the sensuality of feeling the world and being in the world, being outside in the world, to, you know, whatever sexual self-expression you might be inclined to enjoy. You said in the beginning that you have a few poems that we can maybe share for our listeners so they get an impression of what this indigenous erotica does and how it works.
How it works.
And if you'd like to, I was wondering, I can read one too if you want me to, but I'm sure you're a good reader as well. So I don't know. I like there's one with the socks, men leaving the socks on during sex.
Oh, yes. that one. That's an awesome Richard Van Camp one. Richard is Dog Rib. He's a good friend of mine. He lives in Edmonton with his wife and son. So I am going to read a Tennille Campbell one. Tennille Campbell is Cree, Stolo, Dakota. And she is currently doing her PhD on Indigenous sexualities and genders. So here goes. I'm tired of thin, pointy lips. Lips that cut and hiss. They're right for Chief Wahoo and Redskins. Lips that say they don't see race. Everyone is equal. And won't I be their naughty squaw? I want thick lips. The taste of dry meat and glisten with butter, lips that kiss under pine trees and tell me they love me in accents from the land. I want Dene lips, Cree lips, Métis lips, Mohawk lips, and Anishinaabe lips. I want Mi'kmaq lips and Stolo lips. I want lips that are thick with stories and sweetness. Thick lips, moose lips. I want blueberry cloud lips.
Thank you. Moose lips? That's interesting. Lips. Mm-hmm. I'm imagining moose lips here. I wasn't aware. I have to, you know, I don't have an image of moose lips before me right now, so I have to think about it.
Yeah. They're kind of like, they have a, like a horse face, so their lips are kind of big-ish. Yeah.
Big and soft, and yeah. They do the swallowing, well, the reaching out with the lips too, right?
Then that's like, right. That's right.
You know, it's like the lips are a little bit like fingers when they, yes. when I work with, or when I, you know, meet horses, that's what I like when I feed them carrots. They have this little thing going where they
moose are like that.
Yeah. Thank you. How did you get into Indigenous erotics?
There was a couple of things that happened. So the first thing is my mom used to read these true love magazines. They were like at the grocery store. They look like women's comic books almost, like they had these true love stories. And she saw me reading them one day and she said, "You can't read all of them." And I'm like, "Okay." So she put a big X on the ones I shouldn't be reading
because they were
a little bit sassy, you know, a little cheeky. And of course, that saved me time. I'm like, those are the ones I want to read.
Yeah.
So that happened. And then, you know, I come from a long line of storytellers, and we have a trickster in our culture called Wasaki Jack. And we're not allowed to tell Wasaki Jack stories in the summer, only in the winter. And so I was in New Zealand and I was on the marae with a bunch of Maori people, and they have a trickster named Maui. Mm-hmm. And so we stayed in this sacred space, and it was like, you know, you eat there, you sleep there. It's made for like celebrations and things like that. So we started telling stories. And so I would tell Wasaki Jack stories and they would tell Maui stories, and they were so similar. We have similar creation stories, similar flood stories, like just really similar stories. And as the night got later, the stories got a little more bawdy, like a little more cheeky. Mm-hmm. And that's when my storytelling faltered. I didn't know any stories about Wasaki Jack getting into like trouble in these sexual escapades, mm-hmm. or doing things that were risque or anything to do with sex. But Maui did, like they had all this. And then I thought, like, well, I know all these Wasaki Jack stories, but I don't know those stories. You know, our trickster is just as selfish and gluttonous and, you know, as the next one. So why wasn't there any? And then I thought, well, maybe there are, and my family just doesn't know them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there has been a history of colonialism in Canada and all ongoing, and, you know, residential schools happened that, you know, little children from 4 to 16 were taken away and put in schools over the course of many generations. And so, you know, the Catholic, Presbyterian, Lutheran, Anglican churches all had very close-minded views about sexuality and sex. And so, you know, if we had these types of stories, they were certainly not encouraged to be retold.
Yeah.
And so these Western, Euro-Western values and understandings about sex and sexuality was put under, and it was very puritanical, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we carried that. And so I was in the middle of my PhD when I had this revelation of maybe instead of talking about, because it was on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, maybe instead of talking about that, I can also talk about body sovereignty. I can talk about agency, because I started finding all these poems and stories and art on Indigenous sensualities, Indigenous erotics. And I'm like, there's something to this. And so I changed my whole PhD and started talking about Indigenous erotics as a way to have body sovereignty for Indigenous women, and talking about agency and authority over oneself, and really oftentimes a subversion. Mm-hmm. You know, people see, as you mentioned earlier, like Pocahontas, they have these ideas of Indigenous maidens or crones. And so to flip that and be subversive, talking about gender that's on a spectrum, sexuality can be on a spectrum. And now I think for the most part in North America, we're coming to an understanding like, gender is on a spectrum. There's various kinds of sexualities. But Indigenous people knew this a millennia ago.
Yeah.
It wasn't even a question that there was only male and female. There was so many things in between, right? And outside of that. So it was really exciting to me as I got further into researching Indigenous erotics and how freeing that could be and how funny and cheeky it could be. And I know you're going to read a poem by Richard Van Camp that's incredibly cheeky. That's really fun. So we can talk about our bodies in a really fun, enjoyable way. Like they were built for pleasure. They were built for so many thing. So people get incredibly uncomfortable when they talk about it, though.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But I think that discomfort is such a productive position to be in, because it, you know, that's why I wanted to start with this weird self-assertion of my own bubbliness when it comes to our talk today and you know, talking about this, because it's something that I'm struggling to find the right way to address this, maybe in the classroom, but also in my scholarship at large. But that's when it gets really interesting, you know.
Yeah.
I can be the 500th person to write about, I don't know, Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven, but I'm not interested in that kind of scholarship. I would rather do something that, you know, is up and coming in a double sense right now. So that's why I really enjoyed reading so much Richard Van Camp's ironic and funny story. And I would like to say, this, of course, has nothing to do with me, but I think many people can relate to this in many ways. It doesn't, I don't think this conundrum is totally limited or plays out only to indigenous sensualities. I think, you know, there's a nice teaching moment here. Mm. So what to do when your Indian man doesn't take his socks off during sex anymore? Ladies, I got some bad news. If your Indian man isn't taking his socks off during sex anymore, the show is over. It isn't because he remembers waking up in the tent on the trap line on those cold tundra mornings. I hate to break it to you, but he may be thinking of your cousin or your best friend. And those socks are the perfect metaphor for of cold feet and a man already gone, don't you think? What to do, you ask, where to go? Maybe a little louder. Maybe take the initiative again. Maybe head back to the land, cause sex in a tent with your legs just high is where it's at. Basics, baby, basics. Back to the land will bring him around. Maybe. Or you can always insist he take off those socks. Remind him that men of all colors have burned down their houses, abandoned their vehicles, and quit paying taxes, just aching for your body. And if that doesn't work, tell him about that Inuk I seen in a swingers magazine who's from Iqaluit. This thirsty angel will show up at your doorstep with a bottle of barbecue sauce, and he'll pour it all over your toes, and he'll slurp it all off, too. He's a foot licker. He'll suckle those toes of yours like succulent shrimp, and make those happy num-num sounds, like your old man used to when he knew the sweetest canoe was between your legs. So maybe you remind your man that he's not the only bull around, and it's pretty easy to find that Inuk with a bottle of barbecue sauce, or someone like him, just fucking starving for you. Richard.
Nice. Well done.
You can hear me laughing in between the lines, because it's also a story, you know. It's not your conventional poem, obviously. It's really, you know, also a good dressing down of the man, and also an encouragement to the woman to say, come on, guy, get yourself together. Yes, I like the move. Men of all colors are burning down their house to be with you.
Quit paying their taxes.
The socks metaphor here. You said you had another poem. Would you like to read us one more?
Yes, sure. This is another Tennille Campbell, because I love her and think she's amazing. So one of the things that I love about Tennille is that she will video old grandmas and grandpas and aunties and uncles reading these her poems, and they get all embarrassed and they cover their mouths, and it's just hilarious. This one's called Thick Indigenous Women. Thick Indigenous Women are spilled beads and tangled thread, worth the time to pick up and untangle. We are curves spilling stories against your lips. Our thighs are soft muskeg, protecting good medicines, our skin soft as tan hide. Caress us with care as you are touching our ancestors' wildest dreams. Thick Indigenous women are the feast during a long winter. Canned raspberries, fresh bannock, warm butter leaking between your fingers. Come and eat. We hold joy in every round shoulder, laugh loudly, drawing all eyes. We squeeze against you and you hold us tight, smiling at your blessings. Because thick Indigenous women, we are magic. And if you aren't careful, someone else will pick up spilled beads and untangle threads.
Ooh, more competition here.
That's right.
I like this competition element. I mean, of course, it's a wonderful celebration of body positivity. It's also such a settler term, but I think there's a inch in there. But yeah. Obviously, I mean, it's there for the taking, and it's not the rape fantasy here that plays out, but the, you know, female.
There's an agency in her words. There's an authority where there is a control that she has, even though she's offering herself. There's a control, I think, that subverts that sort of unconsensual sex.
Yeah, exactly. And there's so many play notes in between, you know, the extremes of consensus and seduction.
Mm-hmm. So what I really like about that and why I loved Audre Lorde, and I see these similarities, because Audre Lorde was a strong Black feminist, lesbian writer, social power woman. I want to read a quote from her and make those connections with Richard's poem and Tennille Campbell's poem. And this is a quote from Audre Lorde. And she says, "Our erotic knowledge empowers us, becomes a lens through which we scrutinize all aspects of our existence, forcing us to evaluate those aspects honestly in terms of the relative meaning within our lives. And this is a grave responsibility projected from within each of us, not to settle for the convenient, the shoddy, or the conventionally expected, nor the merely safe," end quote. Yeah. And I think about how Indigenous women in Canada and the States have, you know, gone missing or been murdered, you know, 25 times more than any other woman in Canada anyway. And how the erotic in this sense, you know, gives back that agency. And a lot of people in Canada, and it's dying down a little bit more during Halloween, we have people dressing up as Pocahontas or Pocahontas in these skimpy little feather and leather dresses. And they think, well, what's wrong with that? But when we look at how many Indigenous women have gone missing and murdered, the connection between making our culture somehow a one-dimensional caricature, you know, it dehumanizes us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is why those types of costumes aren't a good thing to wear or a good thing to prance around in, because Indigenous women are so much more than one-dimensional characters, right? Mm-hmm. So I love when Audre Lorde talks about this, not settling for the convenient or the shoddy or the merely safe, to step outside of that. And not just for Indigenous women, but all women.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And here I'm going to make a little bracket and acknowledging is the wrong word here, but I want to quickly talk about this particular European or German take on Native American cultures that is based on romantic misconstrual. And you mentioned this in the beginning, based on a fantasy of a white Dresden writer who wrote Western romances without hardly ever going, and who has been overly successful in the German cultural archive, and who has given space to fantasies of white male self-assertion and playing Indian, so to speak.
Yes.
I don't want to spend so much time on this, because the airtime that we have today is too scarce for this. But I just want to say to listeners who are maybe from the cultural realm that I am working on and working in, that is another way of layering on to the Native stereotypes and taking away agency. So, and I don't want to even say the guy's name, because I'm so bored. by its cultural meaning. So it is, that's another impetus for me to be doing this episode with you today. I want to really, really talk to you about your contemporary project that you're doing, TP Conversations. This is a show that happens that lists sexual confessions and maybe cheeky show numbers at Toronto, right? If I understand this right. And I want to particularly ask you about the TP context and how you translate the Indigenous erotics into this playful, self-assertive agency and an artistic expression of body sovereignty in the contemporary popular culture industry. Yes. So maybe you can talk to me about this or talk to our listeners about this. And I would love to see such a show, but it seems they're not taped. So if ever I get to go to one, I would love that. But yeah, that's my other question that I have. So do you tape them, and can I watch it sometimes, because it's so intriguing as an artistic project?
I think the last one we did was online, because we had to I'll get to that, but it's TP Confessions. And a TP, for those of you that don't know, is a conical shape, usually made out of lodgepole pine and buffalo skins. And it's what plains people usually lived in on the plains. This was all Indigenous people, did not live on the plains. Canada is a big place, lots of different kinds of dwellings. So this was Cree, Blackfoot, anyone on the plains would have a teepee. So TP Confessions, it actually comes from a Austin, Texas, group of social justice warriors and feminists. They started something called Bedpost Confessions. So I have to mention them because it wasn't completely an idea that we came up with. Mm-hmm. So we're friends with them. And they had created a space for people to come enjoy, spoken word, poetry, burlesque, acting, anything performative, singing, dancing, that had, a sensuality to it or a sexuality to it. And so Kim Tallbear came up with the idea, hey, how about we have something like that here in Edmonton? I was in Edmonton at the time. So we became co-producers along with Kirsten Lindquist, and we're all Indigenous women. So we wanted to create a space that would celebrate our Indigenous sensualities and sexualities and the erotic, but also creating a place where people, a safer place that people could feel like they could discuss taboo, or what you said, taboo topics, right? We started, I think, in 2009 in Edmonton, and we've had 10 shows in and around Canada and the States, Seattle, Toronto, all over. And so the funnest part is the audience participation. Mm-hmm. So we have something called Confession Fairies. And mm-hmm. so they have That's these big great. Rainbow wings, and they walk around the audience and they hand out these little cards that says, I confess. And you can do more than one confession. The audience writes on the little card anonymously, I confess. And then they hand it back. And then the two MCs, usually me and a guest from that territory or someone from that territory. So we read these in between the acts on stage. And so we read out these confessions. There's no names or anything, but yeah. And it's hilarious. It's a beautiful space. I've learned a lot. I mean, I wrote my whole PhD on Indigenous erotics, and there are terms that I didn't even know, like terminology. And I'd be reading these cards on stage going, oh, I have no idea what that means, because everyone's laughing. I'm like, what does it mean? I don't get it. So even I was learning mm-hmm. some new words, and yeah. It's not only funny, but it's, we know laughter is medicine, right? And it's yes. healing, but it gives people a chance to, hear these confessions and go, okay, so what I'm doing isn't that odd or out of place. And so it's a beautiful space. And we've seen some amazing acts. January Rogers. She's a Mohawk here in Hamilton. She did this beautiful act with honey. All of this honey, like it just, it was just glorious to watch. And she worked really. Yeah. We've had burlesque. We've had spoken word poetry, interpretive dance. It's been really amazing.
Now that you're talking about it, I also think it's not something to be recorded, because the audience participation with the confession and the confession fairies and the act of kind of semi-publicizing your practices or your maybe also your concerns, and then having a kind of a collective response to that. I think that's the artistic part of this that allows for healing maybe, but also just, you know, agency and self-assertion. So I like that this is something that you can't, it seems to me like something that you can't record and play over and over and over and repeat, because that's going to make it reproducible. And that's not what I think this would be. I would love to be a part of this sometime.
lot of fun. Yeah.
And I think the artistic part of it, you know, to have performances, to have many people coming together in this, and basically entertainment, also taking entertainment to that other kind of level where it can be healing and cathartic in the best sense of the word.
Yeah.
It's super appealing. And I think it speaks very well to what I understand as Indigenous erotica. And
It would be amazing to have a show like that in a place in Europe that has misconceptions about Indigenous people and romanticizes Indigenous people. It would be an eye-opener, definitely, for people that are like, well, Indigenous people aren't supposed to be doing that. Where's the feathers? Where's the leather? Don't get me wrong, those things are great, but we're much more than just that.
Yes,
and these shows would definitely be a shocker, I think, in some places.
But a good shocker, I think.
Well, maybe if you find a patron that would like to bring us there, we'd certainly think about going there. That would be fun.
Let's see where this goes in the future. I think this is also a good perspective for future tasks for American studies, maybe, or for, incorporating performance cultures and opening up the European paradigm of colonial performances and theatrics. From an academic perspective, I can relate to it, but also from a perspective of the question of where can American studies go to acknowledge its settler colonial origins and, you know, make more room and space and allow for other epistemologies to surface without the heaviness. So it's important to note, walking back through our conversation, it's important to note that you start with pre-contact cultures, and then you acknowledge the violence and the shame that happened, but the celebration of joy and of agency, of sovereignty, is so key.
Yeah, exactly. That's my pedagogical model, really. It's a kiss, kick, kiss. You start off with a kiss, you know, and then there's some hard truths that we have to understand and wrap our heads around. And then there's the kiss. There's the celebratory resurgence and reimagining of Indigenous peoples and culture and sensualities and erotic. Yeah. So kiss, kick, kiss. That's,
kiss, kick, kiss.
Keep it simple.
Keep it simple. That's a lovely, I think it's also a lovely ended point to our wonderful talk that we had. Thank you so much for being my guest. Thank you for, you know, sharing, commenting on my bubbly questions here, and thank you for bringing the poetry and the work to this.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and who knows, TP Confessions goes to Berlin. I don't know.
It should. Thank you very much for coming. This concludes our November session of Lady Fiction for National Native American Heritage Month. But I think, as we've seen in the conversation, it goes beyond the national into the sensual and to the land. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the AmericaCentrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.